Well, thank you very much, everyone, for coming. And sincere thanks to Stephanie for that really lovely and touching introduction, and to Mark for co-directing the center and inviting me, and Adam Charnow behind the scenes, doing all sorts of magical, important things. And although she had to send her regrets, Dr. Leah Vosko was a key supporter of having this discussion here, and so I appreciate it. And I do suspect that some of you might be reading Abby Hoffman and his strategies for how to survive as a student or as a young worker, and where to find free food. And so this is one of those places, and we can certainly enjoy that a little bit later. So how many of you have worked in retail at some point before? So that's about 40%, oh, maybe 50, 60%. Yeah, and that's very common, especially on university campuses. So I was 6 years in retail, and it was during the Harris conservative era when minimum wages were frozen for 8 full years. So I made $6.85 for 5 years, after which my store manager, who'd been serving almost as long as me, argued really, really hard for me to get a raise to $7.10 an hour. So I do still sometimes have flashbacks, and like many who have or continue to work in the sector, know firsthand some of the post-traumatic stress and related challenges that come from service work and low-wage service work. And the interesting thing is that when I the seeds are, of this project are actually in that I initially wanted to write the next great Canadian feminist book. And I thought, if I want to understand where young women are at, who is the typical woman in Canada? And she is, in fact, a retail worker. And so that was what inspired this this study and this research many years ago, even though in the early stages I would read my interview transcripts and I would, you know, have convulsions remembering what it was like and being really angry at how people were being treated. And but because it's such a significant sector, because it's so important for the future of our economy, I continued to do this research and expanded it and thought, we don't want to just understand how things are, but we want to understand how things could be. And that was the spirit that that inspired this project. So a few goals for today. I suspect some of you have different interests and different levels of familiarity with this topic, with the book and my writing, etc. I know some of the grad students have read parts of it, which is great. And so these are the things that I hope to accomplish with my talk, and then we can go in the directions that are most fruitful and productive for you following my remarks. So just beginning by contextualizing retail work and workers, thinking about some of the strategies for change, both the challenges and the possibilities, then situating retail within a larger economy, thinking about what insights can we induce from retail about the sector in particular, but also about our societies and our economies more broadly. So those are my goals. It's crucial to briefly situate retail in its historical context. So if we look perhaps at the last 100 years or so, and these are two excellent, perhaps underread books that I wanted to flag to help us understand how we got to where we are. So, I mean, initially retail was men's work. It was shopkeepers. It was a dad and a son often who provided things in small communities. And that was largely replaced through the ascendancy of department stores, Eaton's in particular. And some of the smaller shops continued, and retail began to shift towards being more of a feminized sector. Men continued in warehouses, in management positions, but frontline positions, catalog offices. Many of you do not know or remember this, but people, especially far out in the country, would have to order stuff from afar through a catalog, kind of like online shopping today. So that idea has a bit of a longer history. And so women were doing that work in particular. And so Donica Belisle, who's at Athabasca, has done a really interesting study, includes chapters on some of women's early organizing efforts, why retail didn't get organized to great extents, and so forth. And Nan Enstad has written another book, Ladies of Labor, Girls of Adventure, which looks at garment workers in New York City in particular, who were mostly immigrant girls, 17, 18 years old, who were not seen by some of the unions, even necessarily by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, as real workers, as it were. so quotes around real workers, yet they engaged in very militant forms of political actions in the thousands. And so there is this longer history of how retail itself developed as a sector, but also how workers' forms of political action developed, and how unions did or didn't succeed in engaging with the retail workforce. Okay, so it's this history which has led us to today. There have been isolated pockets of workers really resisting and engaging in quite inspiring forms of political action. So on the left are some of the young women at the Woolworths in Detroit, who, in the context of a number of sit-down strikes in factories, so for example in the auto plants, when workers sought to exert their power rather than leaving the plant, they actually sat down in the plant so that machines could not physically be operated without them, these women thought, well, maybe we could try that. And so they occupied this Woolworths store for a number of days in 1937 and succeeded in getting their union recognized, in getting a number of things, small pay increases, company laundering of uniforms, right? In any context, different issues are going to be important to different workers. And so it is heralded as a really interesting and quite exciting example of, again, 17, 18, 19-year-old women in particular taking action, uniting together and taking action to change their conditions. Now, what's not as often talked about is that they lost their union contract about 6 months later, because back then, which continues today, there's very high turnover in retail. So people are going in and out of positions, even if they're simply going down the street to another retail position or down the mall today. And so those union-supporting women were replaced by anti-union workers, by management. And so a mere 6 months later, they lost that contract. So on the one hand, an incredible example of political action, but we can't just get excited about political action on its own. It has to achieve meaningful things for workers. And so it's important to learn from these kinds of lessons. This was a big strike at the Dupuis Fer store in Montreal, I believe, mid-20th century. I enjoy it because it's got the mix of my research interests. It's got the animals and it's got the retail workers there together. Although I always say that I suspect the police horses and police dogs would like to join workers when they're engaging in political action. And there have been these little pockets here and there, 1937, 1954. This is a fantastic photo from the early 80s, so there was an Eaton strike out of six Eaton's locations, I believe, mostly across Ontario, and your own Dr. McDermott, Patricia McDermott, has done some really great writing on this and the women's experiences therein, that they too felt very empowered by taking action, but also very betrayed by their neighbors and their friends who crossed their picket lines. And this is these women led the International Women's Day March here in Toronto. And this, does anyone know who this is? She's a very important labor figure in Canada, so her name is Madeleine Perrin, and she was an incredible organizer of textile workers and garment workers and workers who were often forgotten, and she was very key to this Eaton strike. So there have been these little pockets and these moments of political action, but there's more detail in the book about how retail workers often ultimately felt betrayed or felt abandoned, or that there was initial support for them from the broader labor movement. The Oakland General Strike was inspired by retail workers. After the Oakland General Strike itself ended, they were on strike for many, many more months and ultimately went back feeling very defeated. So this longer history gives us examples that we have these moments of engagement and possibility, but that so far there has not been the unification of these efforts or the building of a really strong, really elaborate movement. So that's situating where we are today in terms of workers' perspectives. So a note on the retail sector and what I mean when I say retail. So it's private sector service work predominantly. Okay, so it's usually for profit. And some folks will lump food service in with retail, which I think is perfectly fine. There's a lot of connections between different forms of private sector service work, where you're helping people in the private sector doing something. I focused explicitly on retail in the sense of stores. Okay, and so this gives you a sense of how the retail sector itself is organized. It's not homogeneous. There are, in fact, many different things going on, different sizes, different things being sold. Food and beverage is still the largest, right? And that's where we see most of the union density. That's where you have slightly larger workplaces, and you're more likely to see collective agreements and collective representation for workers. And then it's interesting how it it scatters from there. And it'll be interesting to see how the retail sector itself continues to shift. But it's an important reminder. The retail sector is not homogeneous. Retail salesperson is the most common job for women in Canada. It has been for a few years now. So women are more likely to be retail salespeople than anything else. Retail comes in again at number four, cashiers. Okay, so number one and number four position for women in numbers, not in quality, are both to be found in the retail sector. And I find this data very interesting. Some of you may have seen this in your courses. In terms of what are we actually doing for a living? I think we have perceptions about what we do. And here's the truth about what we really do. Very interestingly, retail salesperson is also the most common occupation for men. That's newer. It's been truck drivers for much of the recent history. Okay? So retail salesperson comes in first for men, and then retail trade managers comes in at number three. So there's retail again, but a very different position. The ones that are more likely to be full-time, the ones that are more likely to be slightly better paid. Okay, so that's very interesting data, too, again, about what Canadian men really do for a living. But retail salesperson is common across both. So we do, at the same time, within retail, have a bit of gender division, where their large majority of managers are still men, and women are the majority of salespeople and the large majority of cashiers. So even though retail salesperson is number one for men as well, there are just more women in those positions. So retail overall is about two-thirds women. In terms of age, sometimes it's perceived as only a young person's occupation or only temporary, only for students. And there is a high proportion of young workers. So 28% are under 24, and 25 to 34, about 30%. But there's a really sizable proportion of sort of middle and older age people, and the median age is 34. Okay, so it's quite different than what people expect. And particularly in major urban centers, you do see a great racialization of private sector service work overall, especially when it's low paid, and that's very true in major urban centers for retail as well. This is the Global Labor Research Center sponsored event, and so I thought it was helpful to give you some snapshots of the global situation. If you look across industrialized countries, in general, about 10% of the workforce is in retail, so 1 in 10. That's true in Canada as well. Okay, so about 10% of our workforce is in retail. That is, in fact, our largest employment sector. Okay. There is a giant... maybe not as attractive, maybe even ugly giant, some might say, in the retail sector known as Walmart. There's another big red one that maybe we'll talk a bit about later. But Walmart is the largest private sector employer in the world. It's actually the second largest employer on the planet, period. Any guesses on who's the single largest employer?
Government.
Sorry?
Government.
It's Chinese military. So Walmart comes in second in terms of numbers. So yes, public sector work in China. It's the largest employer, followed by Walmart. And if you look at the proportion of retail workers in a cross-section of global cities, there's some pretty striking data. So about 1 in 4 workers in Hong Kong is in retail. From here up is 20 above. Istanbul, Mexico City, Mumbai, Moscow, Kuala Lumpur. 1 in 5. And then very high proportions across the board. And across, you know, Buenos Aires, Stockholm, London, England. A little closer to home, 15% in LA, or 14.2%. Just under 12% in New York City, 10% in Chicago. Okay, so that's quite stark. Startling data in some ways. It's just how high a proportion some of these workforces are. How many people are involved in retail across the world. Now, I know y'all are very interested in cities at York, and we are certainly in the middle of a big one, but retail is significant in both rural and urban contexts. So, for example, 16.3% of the workforce in Toronto is in retail. Niagara region, where Brock University is located, it's a great university, is a cross-section of smaller communities and lots of rural spaces, 17% retail, very similar. And in a lot of smaller and medium-sized communities, the stores are big employers. There may or may not be some kind of a plant. There's always going to be some kind of grocery store. There's often a drugstore, maybe a liquor store, maybe a hardware store. And so these are actually quite significant employers, in particular for finding work that's close to home, for people in those communities that might be a little bit further out. So I suspect in a lot of your courses, you hear about precarious jobs in your lives. You probably experience some precarious jobs, and retail is very emblematic of this rise or this scourge of precarious work. It's perhaps a little bit better than some examples in that it's climate controlled. You have pretty good lighting. You like get to be around some nice products if you like the stuff that's being sold in your store. But your working conditions are not good. It's low wage. It's very temporary and erratic. You may only be able to find part-time. Your hours can fluctuate at random, and they will. Right? Most retail workers right now have seen their hours being cut. Okay. And it is a very poorly paid sector. Okay. So when I'm talking about retail wages, I'm talking about the front line, so who's actually in stores. The Retail Council of Canada likes to inflate their numbers you could argue that that's what they're doing. It's trying to inflate their numbers. And so when they provide data on the sector, they're including people in the head offices or the corporate head offices, which is why they get these numbers that are like the average wage is $15 an hour, $18 an hour. That's because some people in there are making a million. There's a bunch of people making a few hundred thousand, and that's pulling the numbers up. Okay. So I'm looking at frontline, and I'm using the median. So that's half. Half of people are above, and half of people are below. $11.15 in Canada, right? That's basically the minimum wage, the floor. Retail has always had a higher proportion of part-time work than other sectors, but it's now at a staggering 48% part-time. Most of those are not management positions. It's the salespeople and the cashiers who are the highest numbers, and they are the highest proportion of part-time work. The reason that wages need to be singled out and are particularly important, I think, is really nicely exemplified by this cartoon, which is that what people make, what most people make, supports the rest of our society. So if most people have a lot of disposable income, they're going out to local restaurants, they're contributing to local community groups, they're donating to charities, they're shopping, they're going to events. If a lot of people have minimal money, they're doing that less. And so all of those organizations and businesses suffer. The less people make, the less they also pay in taxes. Right? And what do our taxes pay for? So many essential things. Right? Our healthcare, our schools, our roads, our environmental testing, our emergency services. Right? So it's very much in everyone's interest when there's most people have more money. For the reasons that I think are nicely illustrated by this image, that people's wages are very much the foundation of societies. It's not just about money. The experience of retail is often very stressful, depressing, miserable, you know, adjective of your choice. You see things like this. Dr. Ross loves cats, so I had to have a funny cat image for her.
You sound like a cat lady now. Oh, God.
She is a perfectly healthy cat lady. And the experience, the daily experience, can be very frustrating. So, for example, we know that 133 Target stores are closing, and that 17,600 people at minimum are losing their jobs as a result. And I've seen some of them very angry at the company, and others are very angry at customers. They're actually turning their blame to people and saying, oh, you all come running in now that there's these sales. Where were you 6 months ago? As though this corporate decision is our fault, right? And there are some complex dynamics in terms of how working in these sectors where you get treated badly on a daily basis affects your ideas about other people, affects who you think you're in solidarity with or even in coalition with. Now, I prefer examples like this. It's become even more timely now. It has a cuss word. I apologize. Okay, so workers in private sector service, in restaurants, will do things like this. Barbara Ehrenreich found this in her book, Nickel and Dimed, that she said, the reason you get so much ketchup and so much mayonnaise is because that service worker is trying to express their humanity and help you in the way that they can and control one of the few things that they can control. And so things like this, I can't scan this, just take it, is you know, in part a small act against your employer, but it's also an act of, like, you're probably struggling too if you're shopping here or trying to pinch pennies. And so there are more positive examples like this where workers are trying to find humanity in these very inhumane working conditions. And there is an anthropologist called James Scott who's written about this, that people who are not given a lot of formal power or disempowered will often engage in what he calls everyday acts of resistance, or what can be known as weapons of the weak. You can, you know, take an extra 5 minutes on your break, or you can give someone an item that won't scan for free. Okay. Now, my view is that when people unite and feel solidarity, engage in collective action, they more often find that they're not quite so weak, and they can move beyond these sorts of strategies into more effective, concerted forms of political action that are going to address the causes, not just the symptoms. So today we're seeing a diversity of organizational vehicles in the retail sector. And I call them vehicles because I like to think of them as environmentally friendly hybrid cars that you can get in, and you adjust the speed and you adjust the direction. The vehicle is the vehicle. It depends on who's driving and who's deciding where they're going. Okay? So these are different examples of vehicles that workers can get into and then use to go in different directions. So labor unions are the first example. Retail workers have been organizing in networks and associations, using worker centers, which we'll see different worker centers around for cross sections of workers or for migrant workers. There is one so far for retail workers. Community or community labor organizing, particular community labor coalitions. And perhaps we could think of these together as the beginning of a movement. That these are different vehicles, but you know, together they might become a very critical mass. So unionization is a route that working class and middle class people have used for quite a while to try to self-advocate, to try to defend themselves, to try to even that balance, right? When their employer is really, really heavy, if a bunch of them get on the scale, they balance things out a little bit, and they have a little more power, and they have a voice. This is not stock image. These are some of the real workers who organized the H&M at Square One. Okay. And there are different pockets of union organizing going on that are studied in more detail in the book. Again, different scattered pockets, organized for different regions. H&M is a chain that has been particularly targeted for a number of reasons, including because it's Swedish, and in the Swedish context, it's very used to collective bargaining. So about 60% of its workers in Sweden are unionized. And one of the global unions, Uni, has organized what they call a framework of fairness, or a global agreement. They've got about 45 of them, and one of them is with H&M, which is simply getting a global corporation to commit to respecting workers' rights wherever those workers are located. So it's literally following the International Labor Organization standards. It's pretty basic stuff, like we will respect workers' rights to freedom of association is one of the key dimensions. Okay? So that's supposed to say, if your workers try to organize, you'll be neutral. Okay? So often if workers try to organize, the company or their employer will take a firm position and try to convince workers not to organize. This is supposed to say, you be quiet, and you say nothing, and you just let workers figure it out amongst themselves, because workers will have different perspectives, and they will debate. Okay. So we've had a few interesting examples. The Sirens in Bramley was a very interesting recent organizing example. But so far, they have remained quite isolated overall, the second H&M in Quebec, but then it's sort of slowed, and we haven't seen too much new retail unionization in the last year or so overall. And what we've learned from other sectors is that workers do need to have strength in numbers, right, in order to achieve real gains. And so that's something for worker advocates and unions to be thinking about, is that are there different ways that unionization could be approached? And there's two chapters, one on union victories and one on some of the losses that are in the book. And I know that's, I think the grad students read the, it's aptly named Hunger Games and Crying Games. And it's about some organizing in Canada and the United States and things that were found proved to be real challenges, very significant challenges. There's a lot to learn from them as well. Workers have been using a different structure, sometimes called minority unionism. I'm not a particularly strong fan of that name for reasons I explained, but I just like the term networks and associations. That these are largely financed by labor unions, but they're not about joining the union. They're about workers engaging in action and seeking to understand their power, especially between the end of November and December 30th. Retail workers have a lot of power. And through these organizational vehicles, workers have sought to leverage some of that power to educate others, to gain tangible things at their own stores. Our Walmart is an example. They've been at the forefront of the Black Friday strikes and different actions year-round that you've seen in the United States. We did have one in Canada here called Ask Target for Fairness. Okay, so that's the Guelph location. Those are some of the Canadian activists and former York students are even in that picture there. Sometimes these strategies actually cross borders. So this is an interesting campaign financed and supported in particular by the UFCW, which is the United Food and Commercial Workers in the United States, revolving around a company. You have to be very careful how you say their name. They're called Ahold, and they're Dutch. And the campaign is called I Hold. And so it's what? I hold knowledge, I hold power, I hold experience. And so this Dutch company is a grocery chain that has stores all over the world, many of which are unionized. But all of those banners that operate in the southern United States are not. And so this is a campaign that's arguing that those workers, their conditions need to be brought up to that union level. And so it's organizing workers in the southern United States, but seeking to target an employer that's across the ocean. Okay. So far, to my knowledge, the only retail focused worker center is in Manhattan. It's called the Retail Action Project. It was originally a community labor coalition. Then it received a lot of funding from the RWDSU, which is the Retail Wholesale Department Store Union in New York. It's since diversified a lot of its funding sources. There's been attacks on worker centers from Republicans especially. And so they've changed their approach. And they engage in all sorts of things. So customer service training, to get people in, they provide a training and they give people a certificate. Basic resources for people in retail who maybe can't even find a job or have a basic job but can't afford, basic resources, as well as political action, media training. There are a lot of people who in places like Manhattan who want to be artists or actors of different kinds, but they're only able to find work in retail. And so it's trying to leverage their skills and create community, foster an activist culture, but also create community, because so many of these people are devalued in society more broadly. And in contrast, when they go into RAP, they feel welcome, they feel that they're valued, they feel that they have things to contribute. Particularly in urban centers that have a history of community labor organizing, so neighborhood groups or different ethnic groups will link up with workers for different projects of all kinds. And some of them have been retail-centric. So one I like to find, which I find very interesting, was centered around the Queens Center Mall in Queens. And it made the mall the focus and the scale of its activities. So it argued that all of the employers in the mall should be living wage employers, that there should be neutrality if any of the workers therein wanted to unionize. And I think this is very interesting, that the mall shouldn't only be about consumption. They wanted to have community space set aside for ESL training, for community meetings, for different sorts of resources, seeking to change the nature of the shape of the mall. overall. And it was, you know, in Queens, it was a place where a lot of people shopped, a lot of people worked, and so it really made sense in that context to use that mall as the scale of organizing overall. So it's the campaign is sort of wound down, but it too, I think, offers some interesting lessons. I elaborate a bit more on them in the book. So speaking of the book, I begin by asking, what is needed to revolutionize retail? And are these strategies revolutionizing retail? I don't want to give away the ending. It's got great pace, and it's like a mystery. If you're working in retail, you probably know the answer. But I think it's important that we don't just talk about tinkering with things, that we have a more positive vision and say, could these jobs be revolutionized so that retail work lives were fundamentally improved? And this is significant for people of all ages, but because we're at a campus, I thought it was important to pause and identify some youth-specific issues. Lousy jobs are often called girls' work or girls' jobs. And that's making some pejorative comments about gender and about age. Now, I believe that young people, too, deserve good work, unequivocally. But the fact is that retail is more than just work for young women. Retail is representative of the breadth of the workforce. Okay? Along with these kinds of dismissals are, oh, it's unskilled. Perceptions that it's simply temporary or simply entry level. Right? This is the largest employment sector in our country. This is not temporary or inessential. And there's a really great need for us to take it seriously, to combat some of the myths about what's going on there and recognize the diversity of skills that are involved in doing this work. There are going to be lousy jobs. They're going to be boring jobs, tedious jobs, meaningful, rewarding, exciting jobs. No job should mean poverty. One interesting finding from the book that I do want to share is that in many cases, young people are leading the campaigns for change. Even if they're not exclusively those who are working in the stores, as we noted, right? There's a whole range of people of different ages working in retail stores. In the instances where retail workers are organizing, it is workers 30 and under, or 30-ish and under, who are taking the lead. And that's very significant, because there's this perception, you know, in our broader popular culture, that people can be very dismissive of young workers. I won't repeat the adjectives that are used. You know what they are. You live them. But it's in these cases, it's noteworthy that it's young people who are saying, no, this is not acceptable. We need to change things. I think there's a few reasons for that. Many of them have gone to York University, and I'm not exaggerating, especially in the GTA. What you're learning here is applicable in the quote-unquote real world. And a number of those folks who've led these campaigns have said, well, I'm reading about alienation, and wow, I'm definitely living alienation. And then I'm reading about the civil rights movement and how they made change. Well, maybe we could make change too. And making these connections. A number of people are finding that they're in retail longer than expected. They too expected it to be merely entry level or temporary, and all of a sudden it's 5 years later, 6 years later, 15 years later, and they're still there. And so they think, I have something invested, I want to do something about this. There is a broader social justice consciousness among young people. It's very much framed in terms of fairness and social justice. People have experienced homophobia, or they've experienced racism, and they're starting to connect all these dots and say, we deserve better. The people who come after us deserve better. I heard that consistently from workers, that it was about themselves, but it was also about their siblings and people they'd never even met who were going to end up in retail, who they thought deserved better. And many of them were finding that taking action is challenging. Undoubtedly it is. I talk about some of the very real challenges that I identified. But it's also rewarding. And many workers are experiencing like a kind of personalized revolution where they realize that they were leaders. They realize they had abilities that they didn't know they had. And so many have changed their directions, have said, I want to fight for people. I want to go back to school to be a social worker. I want to be a union organizer. I want to stay here, but just make this a better place to work. So I want to just engage briefly in a little thinking exercise. So again, beyond taking stock of where things are, thinking about where things might be able to go. So these things that the horses wear, whether they're, you know, draft horses or racing horses, that prevent them from looking to the side are called blinkers. And you'll notice that not all horses wear them, but they are put on horses to try to discourage them from looking to the side, ostensibly to stop them from getting scared of what's on the other side. Do we wear blinkers, in a way? Do we look in particular directions? And not that the things on the side would scare us, necessarily, maybe some would, but they also offer completely different views and very different possibilities. If we took off our blinkers and thought about retail in a very different way, what sorts of things might be possible? What could be the role of public policy and government? So, for example, scheduling. It's very common to get your schedule a day before. Should the labor laws guarantee advanced scheduling notice? A month? 2 months? 6 months? In Sweden, retail workers know their schedule is 1 year in advance. At the beginning of the fiscal year, the schedule is drawn up. It does not change. You do not get sent home without pay. Swedish retail workers find this very bizarre. I mean, they also get overtime pay for evening and weekend work in Sweden. So it's a very different context. But from that, we could say, okay, well, so maybe we should have a month notice. If they can have 12 months, could we have a month notice? We can plan school, plan childcare, plan other jobs, medical appointments, whatever it is that you need. Living wages to me are not even debatable. It should just be law. That's all I'm going to say about that. If you work, you should not be in poverty. Should there be a retail worker's bill of rights? Should there be a retail-specific bill of rights, or do we want a service worker's bill of rights? San Francisco is an interesting example. As a city, they have paid sick days for all. They introduced the first real live retail worker's bill of rights, which afforded certain basic protections, saying, very significant sector, there should be additional legislation stipulating the things that they need. Should we have that? Other policies that don't have to do with retail directly positively benefit retail workers. So, for example, if there were universal childcare, $10 a day childcare, every worker in every industry benefits from that. Never mind new jobs are being created. Free college and university, it's very common across many parts of Europe and around the world. That would help retail workers, right? If you want to get some more training, you want to go to school, that you don't have to pay tuition fees. And paid sick days for all. Again, I think that's a public health issue. I think there's real opportunity, even in this climate, to make some changes in that respect. About should everyone who's sick just be able to stay home and not lose their pay? We all benefit from sick people being in bed and not serving us as well. Could public policy and unionization go hand in hand? So, for example, could there be a more card check certification? So I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this framework. It's essentially if more than 50% of the workers or more than 60%, whatever the floor is, of the workers, if we were a group of workers in a store and we said we want to have a union and 60% of us signed our cards that said, yes, we want to have a union, that's taken to the labor board. They say, yeah, you got 60% of people. Here's your union. So there are provinces across Canada that have this. We had it very briefly in Ontario, only very briefly, right under the Ray government. I don't know if it was. Do you know, Andrew? What's the history of?
We had it,
and then it was ended by Mike Harris. Okay, so we had this for many years. So it's a possibility. If you don't have card check, what that means is after the cards are signed, there's a second step. That's not seen as enough to indicate that workers want to join a union. You then have to have another vote in the store, usually 7 days later. And that week is very intense because that's when the employer finds out, and that's when the Hunger Games and the Crying Games start, as I mentioned in the book. And employers, many employers will go to great lengths to discourage workers and use a whole host of strategies from very punitive to lots of promises and everything in between. Okay. Now, that said, the provinces with card check certification, Quebec, Manitoba, haven't necessarily seen greater retail organizing. So it's not a magic bullet, but it could play a factor in creating a safer environment for workers to explore options without fear. Interestingly, the brother of a retail worker organizer suggested that there should be referees, as it were. If we're going to have these week-long periods where unions and employers are quote-unquote battling, the Ministry of Labor should provide referees on-site to make sure that the laws are being followed in real time. Because what happens now is that after the fact, unions might file unfair labor practices, etc., that take a long time and are very, very rarely found in favor of the workers. If there's a referee on site in real time, they can say, no, that sign is illegal. No, you can't send that email. No, you can't yell at that worker alone in the stockroom. Just make sure that the rules are being followed in real time. Interesting idea. Would create jobs, too. There aren't that many union organizing campaigns. One referee per campaign, might create 5 jobs. But we'll take anything at this point, right? All about positive. But should we be even thinking more broadly? Is there a role for expanding or creating new retail cooperatives that are run by workers themselves? We have some retail cooperatives that are consumer cooperatives. They're called the co-ops, and they're all across the West. But are there different ways where retail workers could have more power over their workplaces? Could retail workplaces be democratic? Should we have more crown retail corporations or public corporations? So the LCBO is publicly owned, technically. It's a crown corporation. The bookstore on this campus would be a public retail store. Doesn't guarantee great employers or great managers, but does everything that's being bought and sold need to be bought and sold in a for-profit context? Are there options? Some people may have visions, I think, of, like Soviet stores with like sawdust and burlap or something. And I think that we want to challenge that idea and point out that there are public liquor stores in different countries as well. And that, we have said some things should be publicly owned. And perhaps there are certain kinds of consumption that should be public. All possibilities. If we're taking off the blinkers and thinking, what else could we do? And this is because revolutionizing retail, or even reforming retail, is both about changing our economics, our dollars and cents, but it's also about changing how we see ourselves and other people. The strategies being used in the US in particular stem equally from the civil rights anti-racist movements and the women's movements as they do from the labor movement. Right? There's a great anti-racist song from the longer history of black resistance called "Keep Your Eyes on the Prize," and the Walmart workers changed the lyrics. Right, I'll be dead in my grave before I'll ever be a Walmart slave. And this is because these are workplaces that are very feminized, they're very racialized, and that this is very much interwoven with tackling sexism, racism, discrimination against people. Seeing people as worthless or worth less. And if we're going to revolutionize retail, it is going to be about public policy and dollars and cents and collective agreements, but it's also going to be about how do we view our society and who do we think deserves a decent life. I think everyone deserves a decent life. So there are two ways to approach good jobs. Improving the lousy jobs. There are lots of lousy jobs. They're not going to disappear. What can we do to make them better? How can we make them better? And history offers us lessons. The comparative context offers us lessons. We also need to create good jobs. I will never argue that an endless stream of retail jobs is desirable. Retail is interwoven with, you know, you can enjoy shopping, you can enjoy fashion. We need some retail. But we don't need to have this conspicuous consumption that's never ending, continuously buying crap made by people in slavery-like conditions in the Global South, sold here for, you know, by people who are making our country's equivalent of poverty wages. So I don't think the solution is just endless retail jobs. I think retail needs to be approached within a broader vision of what kind of society and economy do we want. Those jobs are going to be here. They need to be better. We cannot sustain this country or any country with lousy retail jobs, with that many people working in lousy conditions. The retail floor needs to be raised, and I challenge us to actually think about how we could revolutionize retail. But there are people who don't want to work in retail. There are people who'd like to do other things. And we need to create new areas of work that are environmentally friendly, that are good for people, that are good for animals, that are good for us all. And there's a number of opportunities, right, in terms of expanding transit, expanding childcare, expanding healthcare. And these two strategies together are essential. The lousy jobs need to be improved, but we also need to create new, good, green, humane jobs. And there is possibility. Undoubtedly, these things are not a given, and they are challenging. Social change is challenging, but it is deeply rewarding. And through learning, through thinking, through exploring strategies, I'm so heartened to hear of this group that Evelina is leading that's going to continue to explore these questions. There is possibility to reform and potentially even revolutionize retail, but also just to create more fair and more just societies overall. Thank you.
So, folks, we'd like to invite you to, we'll just take a moment so that Kendra can kind of catch her breath. We're going to have lots of time for questions, answers, discussion. There's a lot of food here. It is lunchtime. So Mark and I invite you to avail yourself of this, as we will ourselves. Come and get some food, drink, coffee, etc., and then we'll ask Kendra some
very, I'm sure, will be very
interesting questions. Okay? So, I don't know. We'll start up again at 5:00.
Great, thank you.
Sorry. I work in the hospitality industry. We have to run.